is October 18th, 2005. I am Laverne Frank, and I'm going to be interviewing Don Erickson for the Montana State University Archives. We will continue in a second. We'll start with some questions on our little sheet here, and we'll start with, what was your life like before the war?
I joined the Naval Reserve in 1938 when I was still in high school in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I was getting kind of bored and needing some help. In 1939, I graduated from high school and secured a job with a furnace company. And I kind of screwed up pretty bad in some of the things I was trying to do. Then they wouldn't allow me to go into the workers union or anything like that. And so I volunteered for some active service in the Navy, and I was selected in July of 1940 to report to the USS Northampton and along with 10 other volunteers, with 9 other volunteers, there were 10 of us that went into the service on the same ship. And we were transported to Pearl Harbor on a battleship. I don't recall the name of that the ship now, but we entered the Northampton. We had to wait until about August 10th when the Northampton came in from some sea duty, in which we were transferred onto the Northampton, and from there my Navy life began.
How old were you then?
I was about 19, I think.
You were just a young man. What kind of work did your family do? What was that?
My father was a railway mail clerk. He sorted mail on the and carried valuables such as money to banks and so forth on the railway mail cars, and they were all armed. The railway mail clerks were all sidearmed. And had to train and firing their arms and so forth. And they ran from St. Paul to Fargo, North Dakota, and sometimes he ran to Emerson, Manitoba.
What about the rest of your family?
No, she was a housewife.
Did your aunts and uncles live?
It took enough just to keep me going. To keep me in tow.
So, do you care to share a little bit about if you didn't follow the rules?
Well, not too much. I know I never wanted to go back to any high school reunions. Did that answer your question?
I think so. So at this time, were you single or married?
Well, I was single.
Sure. Okay. So.
But I did meet my wife, in either December of 38 or January, I don't remember which, but I was attracted to her immediately.
Is that what you call love at first sight?
I think you would. But she was going to college, and I was still in high school, and she was going to Miss Woods Kindergarten in Minneapolis, Minnesota, which later became a part of McAllister College.
Wow. So she was a college student at the time that you first saw her.
Mm-hmm.
That's remarkable. Woman got to go to college,
yeah,
huh? Smart lady, huh?
Huh?
Very smart lady, huh?
Oh, my ass. Yeah.
At this time, what were your politics?
You mean was I Republican or Democrat?
Well, or
yeah. Or what was I?
Yeah, did you have a preference?
No, I had no preference. I was non-political in that sense of the word, except I was very conscious of the oncoming war.
And how did you feel about that? And were you in agreement?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What about your family? Did they agree with you?
I don't recall questioning them. That's something that would be my decision and my doing to help them. I just don't recall anybody, but I think about that a lot, especially the war over in Germany, That was given more thought, and then when I got to the Pacific, I thought more of Japan.
Was there anyone in your family, like in World War I?
My grandfather was in the Civil War. I don't know much about it because I never did know him.
So you didn't talk about service or the military at that home when you were growing up?
Well, I suppose I joined the Navy Reserve to meet girls.
Did it happen?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. you had a little fun along the way, huh?
Absolutely.
Okay, what did you have any feelings about Germany and Japan or then that time?
Well, it was mostly about Hitler was in Germany was the Nazis. I had ill feelings towards him at that time.
I think that the United States acted like they should or handled it properly.
I think they did the right thing. I think they did it fairly well. And so I have a lot of questions in my mind today about the start of World War II when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. I have questions that still aren't answered in my mind.
Where were you getting your information at that time?
Well, we put out on the ship. We put out newsletters every day. We print them. Did print them, but most of a lot of information came from what they call scuttlebutt. And that seemed to be very, very accurate. I don't think I've ever heard any bad scuttlebutt.
Do you have any German background?
I can see Deutsch.
Deutsch.
Yes, I'm. I'm half Swede. I'm from Yemeni. So I'm half Swede. I'm a quarter German, and I'm a quarter Swiss. And I'm somehow related to the great Wallandos. Am I too loud?
No, you're perfect. You're perfect. I was just making sure it's working. I don't want to miss any of this.
You have
to make you say it again.
Okay.
No, we're good. Did that have any effect on you and how you felt about fighting in Germany? Fact that maybe you had some ancestors there or some relatives?
Well, when I joined the Naval Reserve, I was subject to Navy duty then. And I was called to work in the Pacific once I got into active service. And that's where I worked. And I loved the sea very much. And I feared the sea at the same time. I might say respected. more so than fear, but there's times it's very fearful. But I love being sailing, and it's funny when you're out at sea a long time, you can tell when you're downwind of an island, maybe even 200 miles away, you can smell that island. If the wind is moving right direction and you're downwind of the island, you can smell it, and it never smells good. The sea air and the salt water are one of the cleanest smells in the world, in my opinion.
Had you ever experienced that before?
No.
That was all new to you?
Yeah. Absolutely. And you have it in my writings. But if you want to know, I'll tell you.
Would you tell me again? Yes.
Sure, I will. Well, first of all, now I've got to give you a little bit of history before that.
That's fine.
Because we did some covert work. We convoyed a Dutch merchant that had the first of the Flying Tigers with some of the planes on the deck, anchored down on deck, past the Japanese-held islands and into the Indian Ocean, where a Dutch cruiser took over our duties then, and it was the Northampton and the heavy cruise sister ship, the Salt Lake City. The USS Salt Lake City would be personal, but I don't mess around like that, because the Navy has its own way of calling the shots on towns and cities and stuff. San Francisco was just Frisco. San Diego was just Dago. And there's some towns on the East Coast, I don't want to repeat what we call them.
Oh, it's okay
to do. Well, I don't want to start another war within the Civil War.
I don't think it would happen.
When I get into this stuff, I do have to put myself back in time to how I thought and did at that time. And so I do say things that are a little bit out of line in today's market. But I have to do make myself known as to what the intentions are.
And that's what we want you to do. That is perfectly fine.
So a spade is a spade. So we went to Brisbane, Australia, provided the ship. I had 5 days of the most wonderful liberty that a man could imagine in Brisbane, because all the diggers were over North Africa fighting the Germans. So there's a certain amount of detailed work we had to accomplish. When we left Brisbane, I was in the starboard chains. Now, chains are what you take the depth from by sounding, by swinging a heavy lead, and then at marks on the line, you can tell the depth. And I was working the starboard chains, and the second division man, who had a little bit, some too much 4X beer left in him, was working the port chains. And as we were getting closer to the sea and it was getting deeper, he said to his operator, we each had operators pulling depth up to the bridge, and he said, there's no bottom at the green rag. And they called, and they him hawed a bit. And my operator, phone operator, could hear, and he was telling me what they were saying. And then they finally came back to the chain operator and said, there is no green rag. And the man was taking the sounding said, well, there's no bottom either. That's some of the things that happened because we were kind of turning into an Asiatic bunch anyway about them. And then when we left Brisbane, we went to New Guinea. And we went into the port of, what's the name of that port? Guinea. Excuse me. Where's my phone? Oh, here's my phone. All but six, meet them in the morning.
There we go. Okay.
Now, we're New Guinea. We're at New Guinea, and what's the name of that town in New Guinea? Port Moresby, New Guinea, I think it is. And we charted the harbor and looked it over. And it wasn't all work because an outrigger came by us with three gorgeous girls with grass skirts on. And they had an old little old lady sitting in the bottom of the outrigger, and they were selling fruit. So we had bore garbage cans, or not garbage cans, just cans down, and buy their fruit. Well, pretty soon we bought all their fruit, and then they motioned they wanted to buy, couldn't speak what he had to sign, but that we wanted to buy the grass skirts. So they'd look at this little old lady in the bottom, she'd shake her head no. And when the price got right, yes. So we bought their grass skirts. However, they each had on about six grass skirts. And we bought down to the last one, and they wouldn't sell the last one. So talk about the natives being smart. They're very smart. So we left New Guinea, and then we went to, we crossed the equator at the 180th meridian, and that made us a golden dragon, which is very few of today, golden dragon. And we went to Gabor. I chartered that harbor in Gabor, which the Japanese took over right after the war started. So, but we knew the harbor by then anyway. So that might have helped us a little bit. Maybe not. I don't know. And yes, but we came back from Pearl Harbor, and I had to get this in.
That's good.
That's
just fine.
Because we were actually worked under wartime conditions. From then on, ever since we took the Flying Tigers over into the Indian Ocean, and we were at general quarters every morning at sunrise and every evening at sunset. And this was happened, you know, when we started in something like in the summer of 41. And when we were in Pearl Harbor, we still went to general quarters in the morning and in the evening. However, we got an assignment to deliver fighter planes to Wake Island. And so we took that trip to Wake Island, and we never came within sight of Wake Island, but when we got close enough, we sent, and this was a task force operation. It consisted of the carrier Enterprise under the overall command of Admiral Bull Halsey. And and in, and we were a flagship under the surface command of Admiral Raymond Bruins. So, and we had three heavy cruisers, six destroyers, and the carrier. And on our return, we were supposed to be in Pearl Harbor on the 6th of December. However, on our return, we had to field destroyers, and the weather was rough, and one of our tow lines parted, and the Manila screws, Manila fragments, got into our screw and closed one of the screws. So we had to stop, and the entire task force had to wait for us to clear our screw. And this was why we weren't in Pearl Harbor on December the 6th. And we were, and so we were going to come in on December the 7th. Well, when Pearl Harbor was attacked, first, now this is the parts that I don't understand, is that when Pearl Harbor was attacked, we sent two of our scout planes from our ship and to ascertain the damage that was being done. And they came under fire from a Zeke, which is a Zero. And they, through some freak of balancer thing with the 35 calibers we had and the radio men firing them, we got one of them. And there's only one anyway. But I think it was the smart maneuvering of our pilots that were credited with that kill. This is evidently the first kill of the war after it was on. There was an old destroyer, maybe a four-stacker, I don't know, that was patrolling outside of Pearl Harbor early in the morning of the 7th. And they found a midget submarine. They didn't know what it was, but they saw the conning tower, and they took after it and sank it. Now, this was probably sometime before daylight of the morning of the 7th. And this was not known. Because I'm kind of in the dark on Pearl Harbor why it happened. It seems to me that if our admirals and generals should have been on the alert and got every ship in that harbor on the alert after that, but they didn't. So that's a fluke on our part that this happened. But this was sunk before the war started, before there was any attack or anything. So I don't know if that was when the war started or when it started, when they started bombing us. But we didn't go in on the 7th, but we were very low on fuel, and we would have to go into Pearl Harbor even if we had to fight our way to get in, because we had no petrol left, and we were almost belly up all the ships for lack of fuel, because we made that trip to Wake Island and back without having an oiler come out and give us some petrol. So But when we got into Pearl, we knew that there's a lot of, when we entered Pearl Harbor, we were aware that there's a lot of damage done. But to see it in the smoldering, burning condition, and in such dismay, and so much damage, it just struck us all very, very hard. And it just was something that was uncanny. That it's just so hard to take, because we didn't know anything. We hadn't known about that submarine that was sunk outside of Pearl Harbor in the morning or anything like that. I didn't find that out till later. But the Oklahoma was capsized. There were sailors that had worked them way into the bilges that were trapped on the ship, and worked their way into the bilges, into the double bottoms, and were pounding on the hull from the inside, and they were starting to work on trying to get them free. And so they were trying to cut with their acetylene torches the sailors to free them, and once it got enough room, enough area cut so they could pull a hatch away, the sailors were dead in that area because they'd suffocated from lack of oxygen because of the acetylene torch cutting in and heating up. And there were other parts of the Oklahoma that also had sailors. So they learned to drill a hole and then pump oxygen in while they were cutting through. And this allowed us to free those successfully that were underneath there. I had no part of this operation. I just knew what was going on. And the Arizona was split in half. The foremast was leaning forward, the main mast was sitting upright, and probably at a 45 degree angle, the foremast was almost anyway, approximately, looked like it. And there were other ships rolled over. Let's see, there's one ship that got underway, one battleship that got underway. The Nevada, I believe it was, and by a quartermaster, and they were hit, and so it was beached just before, so that it wouldn't block the entrance to Pearl Harbor. So they beached it near the entrance, and place was such a mess that it just was the only thing was that was any humor was that there's a hole in the canning factory smokestack by, it looked like by a 5-incher. Somebody's aim wasn't that good because they were sure were not shooting at a smokestack. That's the only lighter part of that whole thing. It was just a terrific disaster. And there's some poetry that tells it all. Which is at your disposal now. This piece of poetry is in the museum, the Wartime Museum, in San Diego. We took on fuel. immediately, and because we went in on the morning of the 8th, and before daylight, it took the time to get our fuel because of the disarray that was going on in Pearl. And there's a lot of shooting in the hills that night. We had some sailors, some soldiers, some Marines up in the hills surrounding Pearl Harbor in the Pearl City area. And that was going on. They were evidently test firing. There was a false report that they were making a landing at Barber's Point. And so forth. So it was kind of a jittery night that we had aboard the ship. And when I came in and got moored, tears were coming down my eyes, and I couldn't stop it. I was getting very much ashamed of myself. And then I think we were the second ship in. The destroyer let us in, and we were the second one in. And then along came the Enterprise, and Admiral Halsey standing on the bridge. I could see him very clear, and tears were coming down his eyes. Made me feel a little bit better that I wasn't the only baby in the crowd. And we took off, and when we went to sea in the morning of the 9th, before daylight, I don't know, maybe 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, I don't recall the exact hour we left, but we checked the shipping lanes halfway to the United States to see if they were clear for our shipping to Canada. And our destroyer dropped the huge depth charges and stuff like that on surface carriers, but because everybody was a little bit up in the air on it. And then we entered into Pearl, and around Christmas, and we took on survivors to fulfill our complement from the Oklahoma, the capsized Oklahoma. And there was one man that came aboard ship that I made friends with. He was just the nicest guy in the world. And to go ashore with him and not get in any trouble. He's that type of a person. And, that's the way it was. And so, anyway, I'd made coxswain in November of 41, just before we went to Wake Island, I was promoted to coxswain. So I had a third class rating. I love sea duty. I love seamanship. It's not the easiest duty in the world, but it's the nicest duty in the world for me. About covers Pearl Harbor, I think.
That's a remarkable remembrance. That's fabulous. I'm going to ask you, just thank you so much for sharing. I just really appreciate it. Yeah, we've got it. It's on here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's excellent. I'm going to ask you just a few other questions.
Go ahead.
Okay?
I'll be brief as
you,
I can.
You just tell me whatever comes to you. Do you remember Jeanette Rankin?
Who?
Jeanette Rankin. She was a Republican that ran for Congress, and she was against the war in Germany and Japan.
No, I at that time I was not interested in politics.
Nothing, uh-huh.
I was, my only interest was to kill the enemy.
Right.
And that was foremost in how to do the most damage I could. That was the foremost thing in my mind. I knew my chances of survival was not very good. But that didn't make any difference. I wanted to cause as much damage before something happened than I possibly could. I wanted to do as much. And I told Admiral Struance, asked me one day about how the morale of the crew was. I said, as long as we can get after this enemy and keep him going, our morale is good. And I don't know how, but it seems to me the high brass all knew me. I didn't play much account for them, but they all knew me.
You were a pretty smart man and probably got the word out. Did you tell me where your base of training was?
Well, it was in the Naval Reserve.
Uh-huh.
I didn't go through
just
boot camp.
Pretty much the reserve.
I went sailing on the Great Lakes you can't call it a gunboat, but I guess it's supposed to be a gunboat. The USS Paducah was the name of the ship. I think it, I forget the size of the gun, it's either 4-inch or 3-inch. They had one gun on the fantail and we fired it a few times. I don't think we hit anything and I don't think we're shooting anything.
Yeah. How did you feel about being away from home?
Oh, I probably missed, I probably was homesick, not too bad, for maybe a month. And then the ship became my home. That became my home. And
much contact with your family or people?
No,
at home?
No,
or
not too
any?
Much.
Yeah.
We didn't telephone or anything like that. Wrote letters occasionally.
How often did you go to reserve to be trained?
Oh, as I recall.
So you were enlisted.
Yeah, I was an enlisted man.
Yeah.
I wanted to be. I was offered OCS, but I turned it down because I didn't want to become an officer. I wanted to have a more active part in the handling of men and in the duties of a seaman. You see, I knew mermaids would never let a sailor drown because they just love seamen.
Okay.
Now that's, it's not, well, it's serious.
I'm happy that you know that you can just say what's in your heart and in your mind. That's wonderful.
Well, I get reverted back to those days.
What can you? Did you already tell me pretty much your most memorable moments?
The service.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there's so many, that I just like I couldn't. There's things that I can't talk about today.
I understand.
There are things in my writing that I've left out. And I've got one writing that's pretty complete. But let me tell you about that. I've got one writing that's pretty complete. And that is the last one I've done. I did that actually. The writing for the people of Australia. However, I wanted it done for the on the anniversary of the battle of the what's called the Battle of Coral Sea. The I'm getting screwed up now, like a midshipman's ditty bag.
That's okay. We can correct it.
Not the Babylon Coral. See, that was one we missed, but I can get into that a little bit too, because we got spotted down there, and before the Battle of Midway, and we deliberately stayed. We got down there 2 days after the battle. We were on our way under full flag, but we didn't make it until 2 days after the battle, and we hung around there until one of their planes spotted us, and then that night we took off for Pearl. And we wanted to be spotted down there because we thought they would know what we were in the vicinity, because we knew the Battle of Midway was coming up. And so we ran into Pearl and made a speed run into Pearl and provision ship and took off. And Admiral Bull Halsey got the Chinese crud and couldn't take the trip. So,
what's the Chinese crud?
Just one of those tropical things that get
like
you
bad flu.
Well, they get you full of pimples and you gotta itch and itch and itch. It's a rash, very bad stuff. he recommended that Raymond Spruance handle that. Well, Raymond Spruance was not a carrier admiral, he was a surface admiral for surface warfare. But Bull said he's the best qualified. He knows the job of it. So anyway, Raymond Spruance was in charge of the Battle of Midway. And I can go into that a little bit. Didn't amount to that much of them, due to the cunningness of Spruance. He knew when to hold them and when to bolt. And he was the frightenest little bugger you ever saw. He looked kind of like a tame rabbit. And he was one of the frightenest son of guns that he just knew. He had a sense of timing that you couldn't beat. And in fact, I'd get mad at him when we started chasing the enemy. He'd stop and hold two at night after the dark. And it wasn't until years later I found out we'd have run into 10 battleships if we'd have kept pursuing it after dark to annihilate the remains of this attacking of the surface craft, the destroyers and the cruisers and so forth. So anyway, and I was mad at him until I found that out. I thought, well, he's got a little crap in his blood. So, because I just wanted to fight him. And anyway, we just knocked the living daylights out of him at that time. That was the first time we actually, I don't even know the month that came in. I don't recall it anymore, but it wasn't much. And I saw the Yorktown under attack. They hadn't quite joined us yet. But they were within my eyesight, because I had good eyes. And I saw the planes first when they came back from their attack on the enemy carriers. They were low on gasoline. I saw many of them ditch into the water because they just couldn't land. Can't all land at once on the carrier. And so they were dropping in the water pretty fast. We lost a lot of planes on that. And hopefully not many pilots, because the destroyers can activate themselves and take care of the survivors. They soon came under attack. Yeah. So
So what was it like to meet people from around the country?
What?
To meet people from all around the country.
I got through. I could tell what part of the country a person was from by just talking to it. I knew if they were from New England or from the South, or what, even what part of the South, because of their drawls and the language that they spoke and everything. I just got real good at it, and I could do that pretty much too with England, the English sailors. We had a man in our division from the South, from Mississippi, and he had a drawl about a foot long, and he says, he's talking about the Civil War, and he says, "We'd have won the Civil War if you damn Yanks hadn't cheated." And I said, "What makes you think the Yanks cheated?" "Well, my pappy done told me."